Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen, episode number 74, our first episode or first guest of 2024. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I am Dan Safarik, and the guest today is Davide Dariu. He is a reader in architectural history and theory at the University of Westminster in London. Welcome, Davide.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So we have Davide on board today because he has put together an entire program, entire academic program, as well as published a book on the subject of vertigo and its relationship to architecture. The book is called On Balance, Architecture and Vertigo, and it's broken into three parts which discuss various approaches, both in the physical and the theoretical world, to the subject of vertigo as it applies to architecture. If it sounds nebulous, that's why we have him here to explain how he's approached this topic, which is fascinating. So I guess I'm going to ask the first question, which may seem obvious, but what inspired you to spend years on the subject of vertigo and its relationship to architecture?
Yeah, I think it's a great question to start from. And I personally experienced something which is often called height vertigo. I'm sure it's a phenomenon a lot of listeners are familiar with. And I'm also sure that a lot of medical scientists would disagree. And in fact, they actually pronounce vertigo, something which is currently much more associated with vestibular problems and is completely disassociated with the experience of high places. But historically, we use the same word. And everyone who knows Hitchcock's film Vertigo from 1958 will also relate to that kind of a phenomenon in architectural terms as well. So there's very much of a personal interest and investment in the subject. And obviously over the past decade or so, there's been a growing interest within urban studies, architectural studies in verticality. Stephen Graham's book, Vertical, has become a reference point in that respect. So an attempt to kind of move beyond a kind of horizontal cartographies, which for a long time have set the way in which we understand cities, and to interrogate the vertical dimension of cities, which goes from way from the air down to the underground and bunkers, etc. So, and for me, the question is, what about the experience of verticality? How do we actually feel when we are in a high place, for example, which brings about all this question of embodied sensations, experiences, and also the emotional side of things? Because vertigo, it strikes me as a very interesting concept because it encapsulates the ambivalence between the thrill and the anxiety, which are both associated with this type of sensation.
Well, very interesting. It sort of seems like at a really reductive level, you know, the idea of going up in an observation deck or standing atop of a tall building and feeling that sense of risk, but also that sense of enclosure, you know, addresses one of those fundamental principles of architectural design that I'm, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright and other people have talked about, prospect and vision. But also it's very similar to the kind of feeling of collective release and risk that comes, I guess, with riding a roller coaster or, you know, bungee jumping or any of the other activities, which, as you point out in the book, have increasingly been combined with actual tall buildings and tall structures. So that now, you know, there seems to be a belief that the observation deck by itself, the sensation of being high above the ground and having a panoramic view, is not enough, and that we need some kind of entertainment format at the top of these buildings in order to justify their high fees. What do you think of that phenomenon, the attention economy, I guess you could say?
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a focus of attention in my research. And by the way, this book stems out of a wider project. It's called Vertigo in the City, which is also the name of the website I've set up at Westminster, where I've drawn upon the resources and the knowledge and expertise of a number of scholars and experts in different fields, because it's an inherently multidisciplinary phenomenon. How could I possibly even begin to grapple with something which extends from the neurological side to psychology, philosophy, and of course down to the artistic and architectural dimensions that you just mentioned. And now for me, my personal contribution to this wider project is specifically about what you just mentioned. So questioning how, especially over the past couple of decades, I would say, well into our current century, we've seen a proliferation of architectural design features, should we call them, elements, or maybe even spaces, which seem to embrace wholeheartedly the challenge of vertigo. So vertigo is no longer something which is swept under the carpet, perhaps ignored, overlooked, but actually is definitely being elevated, pun intended here, to a principle, a design principle, which of course adds value to certain architecture. They become attractive to certain thrill-seeking users or perhaps clients. And this actually raises problems. I think it raises paradoxes about, especially about the ambivalence I mentioned before, those people who will seek the thrill of altitude. Other people will absolutely loathe and hate that kind of experience, sometimes without even realizing before they find themselves in those circumstances. So it's inherently ambivalent. And what I do actually propose in the final chapter of my book is a concept, perhaps a tentative way of conceptualizing what we see, as you said, or just all around, especially in vertical cities, as an architecture of vertigo. If you think about the, okay, let's talk about a tall building, a tall tower, whether it's a structure, maybe a telecommunication tower, you go up to the revolving deck, you know, to take up a view from above, or perhaps there's a restaurant there, or even in an office tower where you pay a ticket to enjoy, again, the panoramic scenic view from above. That phenomenon was wonderfully captured by the French scholar Roland Barthes in the 1960s. As an architecture of seeing, basically the Eiffel Tower, right? So the 1889 Eiffel Tower, which completely changed our perception of verticality in cities. I think about 300 meter towers, completely unthinkable at the time. Well, that, in a sense, what is it for? It's primarily about allowing folks to go up and look upon the city from above, right? So it becomes an architecture of seeing or of vision. And as you just exactly point out now, something has been shifted now because these glass floors, so this kind of a jutting up element, which allow you to not only view the city from above, but actually be suspended or immersed in space, almost as though you feel like you're walking on air sometimes. So they are allude to a different paradigm, which I think require a different way of thinking. It's much more of a kinesthetic experience. It poses questions and demands on your sensory apparatus, on your multisensory apparatus. They challenge your balance. And so they kind of act upon our equilibrium in a way that is far more multisensory than the purely visual experience of panoramic terraces. And so for me, that is what we immerse now, and it requires a little bit of new thinking.
The middle part of the book addresses the idea of, well, what you call it, taming vertigo, and that covers one of the best words in the English language, which is funambulism, the act of walking on a wire between two objects, and another topic called urban ascents, which refers more to the phenomenon of people actually climbing the exterior of buildings, such as the famous French Spider-Man, and other protesters and individuals who want to use the tall building as a kind of a billboard for their causes. What are your thoughts about the funambulist? And see, it obviously goes back to, you know, the circuses and perhaps even to, you know, pre-Roman times. I think there was a Babylonic references to it there.
Oh yeah, I mean, they're wonderful historical references to how, you know, walking on a rope, dancing on a rope, as this practice used to be called in ancient times, was performed. Was a way of entertaining the court, the noble, the aristocrats. So there will be individuals, acrobats, who will specialize in this kind of skill and art, and there are actually paintings in Pompeii. So definitely, it was a big thing in ancient Rome, in ancient Greece, and possibly before that. And really, I'm interested in this section of my book, in how actually vertigo is something that stimulates embodied spatial practices. How do I challenge it? How do I tame vertigo? How do I control it? How do I overcome the dangerous effects of vertigo, which of course can be lethal, if that means actually losing equilibrium to the point of endangering our body. And what happens is that if you consider the 19th century, and really to oversimplify, much more complex historical cultural phenomena, but you know, the height of the Second Industrial Revolution, and has been also driven by the conquest of nature, thinking in every shape or form you can think about, the telegraph, mining, etc. You know, is humankind's really dominating nature, of course, an issue which is coming to prominence lately in the discourse around the Anthropocene and climate change, etc. Well, actually, that moment in the mid-19th century is also when these practices explode quite literally in parallel. You have the funambulists who are walking not longer on a hemp rope, by the way, but on wires. That's why the term high wire is coined. These are steel cables placed at great heights. And the great Blondin, François Blondin, the most famous funambulist in history, crossed the Niagara Falls in the 1850s. Now, we are talking about one of the greatest mass spectacles in human history. You know, we're really talking about something big, which at the time was unsurpassed in terms of the clamor it caused. There was people would faint, people would lose the senses. It was something incredible that humans could challenge what used to be considered to be the highest sheer drop in nature. Of course, now we know that there are places in Africa which are taller than that. But, we're talking also about a symbolic place right at the frontier between Canada and the U.S. So crossing that space, the airspace, will also be a very symbolic kind of site fraught with symbolic meaning. So a man crosses that while walking on a cable without any harness at all and endangering his life. So Blondin did it over a couple of seasons, and that triggered a whole new season, a whole new age of funambulism, which gradually into the 20th century enters the city. And so here is where, the urban nature, the canyons of the American metropolis, the canyons, the gorges, and all the metaphors used to describe the vertical metropolis become the new site where funambulists take up those new challenges. So we see then, fast forward in the 1970s, people like another Frenchman, people like Philippe Petit, who famously walked in between the late Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York City. And that is a gesture which almost captures how the challenge of verticality or the attempt to tame vertigo has been shifted from nature to the metropolis. The kind of the sublime is no longer the natural sublime of the mountain, but it's become the technological sublime, if you like, of the high-rise metropolis. And right in parallel, you have almost a similar history I tried to chart in that section, which is climbing. So, the heyday of mountaineering also is mid-19th century, when mostly English men used to go to Switzerland and to the Italian Alps and to take up the great peaks of the mountains. And quite similarly, in the 1970s and 80s, actually, you have the early stages, the early attempts from some individuals to climb skyscrapers and to, again, reclaim what was seen as urban nature. Of course, illegal acts, very dangerous, people got arrested, etc. But also they revealed something about our kind of complex relationship with heights. We're talking about a notion of the abyss, which is transposed from nature to the city. I use the word abyss quite a lot in my book. I think it's a word, kind of old-fashioned word, but I think it's worth rethinking about how we, through our increasingly vertical environments in our cities, in our age, in our urban age, we also construct, we build, we create a new type of abyss, which also demands a new kind of embodied physical and psychophysiological responses to it, which of course brings us back to vertigo. So how do you tame it? Well, these are obviously only kind of the tip of the iceberg of a much wider range of practices which kind of engage with our sense of balance, but I think they epitomize in some spectacular ways also our changing relationship with vertical space.
It's very interesting. I do find it fascinating that that this is a case where technological change in the form of building tall actually did lead to psychological and physiological changes in human subjects. Unlike the fears, like when the railroad was being developed, that people would go insane the moment they crossed a 20-mile-an-hour threshold. So it's interesting. But I guess I have a prosaic question for you from a policy perspective. In the school of urbanism, there are thinkers like I'll single out Jan Gehl, for example, who argued that building above a certain story threshold is effectively anti-human, right? The sort of pseudoscience that we evolved on the savannah and that therefore we have a horizontal plane and that basically, yes, that, building above a certain height is anti-urban, anti-quality of life, et cetera. And then you have a counter-argument, which I've seen mostly from economists, for example, who look to places like Singapore and Hong Kong, where tall residential buildings are a norm, far taller than the standard apartment high rise in the Europe or the United States, and that there's absolutely no psychological effects to that. People can live very well in, you know, relatively tall buildings in multi-story apartments. I guess my question from a policy perspective is yeah, you know, what is optimal height, or which camp do you refer to? I mean, it seems like a minor point here, but it is interesting that there's this sort of bias against living tall. And I'm sort of curious your research and thoughts on this about how that plays into these sort of latent fears of vertigo, or our lizard brain fears of being up high.
I think it's a very important question you're raising, because to some extent, the type of issue we're talking a moment ago about, let's say, tourist experience, you know, from ranging from roller coasters to very high-rise panoramic decks, could be seen as a very kind of niche type of experience. You got the desire, maybe the money to afford that kind of thrill. You do it if you want, and why should anybody else bother? However, this sort of increasing commodification of vertigo actually is now becoming widespread, and we see this everywhere. And we see, let's say, glass parapets, which are now lying in the balcony of any kind of condominium around the world. We see this in museums. We see it, as you mentioned, now in housing blocks. I've been to Singapore. I've been to some of the HDB, that is, by the way, the housing board, which oversees a massive plan for social housing in Singapore. And they're reaching the heights of 50, in excess of 50 meters. So this is a height we would not normally associate with the living. Okay, for an office block, but not so much for living apartment. Actually, you know, of course, they are very desirable because they will have all kind of benefits in terms of, let's say, fresh air in a tropical climate. They have all kind of benefits, and they are very, very sought after types of residential spaces. However, I would actually disagree with the fact that we don't have psychological, that this kind of habitat does not have any impact upon our psychological lives, because this is, in fact, something very contested. And I have actually plowed through quite a lot of psychological, neurological literature, psychiatry, psychoanalysis. You know, we don't really know that much yet, ironically, about how our nexus of body and mind responds to the experience of a certain space. But when you think about the kind of time scale of our human evolution, you know, and think about actually the so-called skyscraper age is only, what, 120, 130 years old? We don't actually know enough about how we as humans can adapt to certain kind of condition. I mean, of course, you know, people have always used, I mean, certain people, certainly certain parts of the world, used to still live on mountains, they still live in proximity with cliff edges, and the abyss is part of our daily life. But actually, when it comes to cities where suddenly, literally, all of a sudden, you are brought to live or work in a very, very high-rise place. Well, one thing we do know is that the phenomenon used to be called known as height vertigo, now referred to as visual height intolerance, and that seems to be now the term used by within the neuroscience. Well, that is something that you cannot fully know about, even if you think that you take heights very well or you don't. Things change in your life, because it's certainly to do with your psychological, with your psychic life, as well as with your more kind of somatic ability to keep equilibrium. In other words, connected also with your vestibular sense, etc. So I do mention in my book anecdotes, because all we know literally is a few anecdotal pieces of knowledge from oral history. For example, oral history of building workers in 1960s Britain, where scaffolders were used to go up and down the scaffolds and putting up some of those high rises in the British capital in the post-war period. All of a sudden, one guy one day will freeze. And freeze, by the way, is the word, as you use technically, you know, without being able to go up or down, and frozen for 3 hours on that damn beam, and somebody else had to rescue them and bring them down, and they will no longer go up at all. They had to change job. And this means the being, accepting the demeaning transfer to a job as a bricklayer, which in that business is a lot. But anyone who's watched Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo might remember that the main protagonist, Scotty, is actually a policeman who retires because of the trauma that he lives during the opening scene, where he nearly falls off a roof edge. So, well, we don't know actually that much about why is it certain people respond enthusiastically with exhilaration to height, and they will go to great length to experience, you know, the thrill of altitude and so on, and others will recoil at just the very idea of thought or an image of anything of that sort. It's quite mysterious and it's quite ambivalent. So I would say, in terms of policy, I will urge both planners, policymakers, to be a lot more concerned with the variety of responses that individuals have.
I do find it interesting that there's a juxtaposition, you know, in the desire to reach great heights that is achieved by some of the, let's call them the Billionaires Row pencil towers in New York, where it's floor to ceiling glass. The building itself is typically a very small horizontal dimension, such that there's a high chance of vibration and of swaying in all directions. So they have to go through extreme engineering stunts in order to prevent that sensation from, you know, I think from upsetting the occupants. I think the test is always, can I see my chandelier swinging? And if I can, then that's too much sway. And so you have tuned mass dampers, you have all kinds of technology, blow through floors to ensure that this happens. And then you have, as you mentioned before, the social housing in places like Singapore, where there's quite a bit of vegetation and planting, and there's a lot there that allows you to step back from the edge and enjoy some of the benefits of actually being outside and experiencing the breezes at height, which are few and far between in places like Singapore. I had the privilege of going up in one of those towers and, you know, hearing a violin concerto. It was actually just a bunch of students practicing, but it was on the 50th floor and it was outside at a park-like setting. And I could sit in the middle of it and have no sensation that I was at height. But then if I went to the edge, you know, the juxtaposition of seeing that activity right up against a planted edge was interesting. But it felt safe. It felt protected. It felt community oriented. Sometimes when you go up in these high rises that are, you know, floor to ceiling glass, which are intended for the extremely wealthy, who you would think would just want everything just so, you know, seem very risky and vertiginous. I wonder if you have thoughts about that, about the class implications or the kind of the challenge to the psyche of the wealthy person who doesn't occupy that building very often versus those who live in a building all the time and want certain aspects of protection from their high living spaces.
Yeah, I would say that particularly the lawsuits that are filed against 432 Park in Manhattan there, where, you know, all sorts of swaying and noise, and, you know, it almost sounds like a haunted house, effectively, you know, the revenge of living tall or owning tall. At least.
Well, that's so interesting, right? So, I mean, there's a bit of a hubris involved in that. Be careful what you wish for, right? So we all know how tall buildings have historically been associated with the status symbol, with power, with visibility. And with the desire also to live, and I'm talking especially about vertical Western cities, to live away from the crowd, to be distanced from the street, you know, place of vice, of crime, of dirt, of noise, etc. So let's just to get out of there, let's be secluded and enjoy the privilege of that distance. If you add on top of that the bonus value of being able to actually contemplate the view, the panorama. And by the way, let's not diminish that. The Eiffel Tower effect is still very much there. You'd be surprised. Just count how many new attractions are built around the world, which use the 360-year number, just literally to brand themselves. The 360 panoramic view is what you want now everywhere in the world, except that, that's what I'm trying to kind of argue, is not, you know, is not purely visual anymore. But yeah, so that privileged subject position is definitely inextricably bound up with class structure. And there's an interesting anecdote I can bring up here, which was shared with me by the daughter of the client of the Seagram Building in New York City. And also she was also the project manager, Phyllis Lambert, and who insisted that her dad, who was, of course, the director of this huge distiller company that from Canada invaded almost to like, you know, colonized the US market after the prohibition was lifted. So they made a huge amount of money by selling whiskey, etc. Right. So when they built their headquarters in Manhattan, the Seagram Building, 1958, by the way, same year as H. Goes Without You, was an interesting moment in, I think, in terms of Vertigo, the late 50s. I'm currently writing something about that moment, by the way. And so she insisted that Mies van der Rohe, the German architect, be commissioned the building. So Mies designs this famous tower, which was the first one in New York City to be, I think, to be fully clad with a curtain wall glass, a fully glazed tower, right? So the glass box par excellence. Except that the glass is not transparent, it's brown gold, because he wants to allude to the content of those bottles and those alcoholic beverages, all kind of mythologies around there. I won't take you through. This is all well known. What's less well known is that apparently, and Phyllis shared with me this anecdote, apparently the real estate companies were quite concerned as soon as the building was completed that office companies were not, corporate agency would not rent out those office spaces because their employees might feel vertigo, may feel uncomfortable having to face this fully glazed facade. And that would be a problem. Simply, they did not know, and they didn't want to take chances. So Mies, the great ingenious architect, he devised something very simple, the ventilation duct that are still currently there, I believe, which are placed along the perimeter of the office space at the lower level. So they create just about a little distance, kind of a barrier, as you said, to make people feel safe. And of course, we're not talking about real safety, because vertigo is not about real danger. It's about perception. It's a perception of being unstable, perception of losing orientation, perception of falling. All right. So in that respect, you hardly ever fall through a thick pane of glass unless the glass breaks, but they're designed not to break. All right. So, and yet still a lot of people will feel very, very uncomfortable in proximity of a glass partition. And I'm now talking about vertical glass. So the vertical transparency makes you feel you might fall down. Your gaze is already falling. You look down into distance, you feel dizzy, all right? So this is a very widespread sensation. So Mies devises a little barrier, which is just as perceptual as it is physical. And suddenly it worked all right. I mean, you know, the spaces were rent and everybody was happy. So, and I think so there's so many different types of safety barriers in our built environment, which are, you know, are worth considering. I think they're worthy of greater attention. I think there should be more research into the way in which also we have been shifting in the way in which we design those barriers to keep people safe, but all the while enabling a certain kind of transparency. You may think about the modernist horizontal rails in the Bauhaus, built, you know, balconies, for example, and then the current trend for transparent, you know, glass parapets, which actually keeps a lot of people at a distance. So, you know, and this is pervasive. I agree. This is not just something for the elite. I mean, this is something that you may find yourself in your kind of, you know, middle-class apartment block. Perhaps by the time you realize, you start having second thought about living in a certain place. It happened to me once, and I just, you know, I felt I wish I'd known before I had rented the apartment. There was a glass parapet out in the balcony on the ninth floor. So if it happens to me, that's my starting point of my research. I'm pretty sure it happens to a lot of people. This is something so difficult to get to know about, because there's no actual quantitative research in terms of the epidemiology of high vertigo. They're only just now starting in Germany to do some kind of research in terms of the data about how people respond to heights, and we're very, very behind of that. But the anecdotal evidence is there to make you feel like this is a serious issue.
It's so interesting that this has been the outgrowth of a personal experience or something that you wanted to overcome, perhaps by studying it from every possible angle. How has the study of vertigo as a subject from the physiological, the architectural angle, and the psychological angle, has it helped you personally? Do you feel like you can now go up in any tall building or any high space and not get those sensations because you've intellectualized it more? Or is it still a very visceral, kind of natural, as Greg says, lizard brain response to being placed at height for you?
Well, it's not gone away, but actually it has helped me. there is something I think psychologists call habituation, which is a well-known method or technique used by professionals to enable people who suffer from particular phobias. So phobias are actually not fears, they're irrational fears, which are treated pathologically, to get to use to certain kind of experiences, and including the experience of height. So people who are on the spectrum of acrophobia, so the kind of irrational fear of heights, they might be helped through certain kind of habituation practices. I haven't done that professionally, but by putting myself through the joys and sorrows of visiting a lot of those buildings and places, I have to tell you, somehow I feel a bit more comfortable. Maybe simply I feel I've been there. I've realized that after all, there's nothing to be scared of. But actually, at some point, something will kick in and you'll still freeze. Which brings up perhaps another dimension, which is virtual reality. A lot of virtual reality experiments done also within the medical field now are done by testing the typical experience of, let's say, walking down that beam, jutting out of the building and rescuing the little cat. That's a famous one. Perhaps you've seen some images of that. Dare you walk down that beam and keep your balance, of course, running the risk of falling down to rescue the poor little cat. All right. So obviously this is done in a safe environment, but virtual reality is so immersive that you do actually have to confront your real, your embodied fears and anxieties until hopefully that helps you to treat your condition. And I am using the word condition advisedly because acrophobia, being a spatiophobia, is considered a psychiatric condition, whereas the broader spectrum of visual height intolerance is something which concerns almost every individual. In fact, if you do not feel any kind of fear at all when you confront certain exposed places of height, probably you have a problem, because it's absolutely human reaction. We are programmed to keep ourselves safe. So there is a kind of natural instinct about recoiling or withdrawing from an edge, keeping safe, etc., etc. But of course, the more extreme case of spatiophobia, they began to be diagnosed in the late 19th century around the same time as things like agoraphobia, claustrophobia. And that came about at the time in which the so-called psy complex came about. PSY, so psychology, psychiatry, psychoanalysis, all developed around the same time in Europe. And at the same time, there were a lot of cases to be treated, because a lot of patients will come to doctors reporting feeling sick because perhaps they couldn't walk through a square, or perhaps they couldn't negotiate a great height. So at that point, when the modern city was really booming in Europe and America in particular, also there was a beginning of a new awareness of those spatial phobia. For some reason I don't quite know, acrophobia, so the fear of heights, has not been investigated that much, which is also another reason why I began to research this subject. It's a bit of a kind of a lack of knowledge, but also perhaps a reluctance from the side of architects, maybe even architectural scholars, to deal with this subject. It's very complex. By now, probably everybody has understood how many, facets and dimensions are of this phenomenon. It's quite intractable. It touches upon a number of disciplines, which perhaps has dissuaded other colleagues from going into that so far. So I ventured into that, and I just feel I've begun to scratch the surface with my book. There are more questions than answers, but I hope that it could also lead to further research.
Well, speaking of spatial phobia for a moment, and since you mentioned VR, it's interesting you did not take the direction I thought you would go because of its well-known nausea issues. So that sort of sense of the mismatch between reality and sort of embodied cognition. Are there any particular lessons, or have you started to investigate, sort of as we build out spatial computing with the impending launch of the Apple Vision Pro, which, is sort of in between VR, but this notion of nesting information in seemingly physical planes, wherever direction we go with augmented reality as well. Have you poked into that at all? Or are there any particular lessons for this as we perhaps move towards a visual information architectural paradigm?
Not really. I mean, that's not been the focus of my particular research. I know other people are doing that. It's going to explode, of course, not just as technology. VR is kind of a weird phenomenon, which was already there as a technology several decades ago for different theories why it never took up until much more recently, maybe also commercial ones. But one thing we have to be aware of is that there are many different ways in which people feel disoriented, they feel nauseous, they feel dizzy, they feel vertigo, they feel all kind of giddiness and instability. There are many, many, many. And the kind of visual sort of apparatus you just mentioned, I'm not surprised. we make sense of the world as bipeds, as people who actually stand on 2 feet, and we, of course, with our sense of sight is very, very developed human beings. And there's a very, very delicate balance system which ensures our stability. At least it kind of is designed to ensure us the balance, so people do not have perfect stability at all. And that is very delicate and it's very fragile, and it's not just one of our senses. If you accept the balance is a human sense, as most people tend to do nowadays, well, the actual apparatus which oversees our balance is a multisensory one. It involves at least 3 balancing senses. So I'm not surprised that visual and optical mechanisms and devices might actually prompt senses of nausea and disorientation, because, you know, we have to bear in mind that probably the sense of balance was one of the earliest senses to develop in human evolution. If you think about how vital it is, the importance of keeping steady and balance, right? So, and keep your bearings. And yet, as an Austrian medical historian pointed out, is the last one that was discovered, because it's only in the 1860s, I believe, that the vestibular science came about, and the Frenchman Prosper Meunier discovered something in our inner ear, where it's called the labyrinth, which actually presides over our sense of stability in connection with the sense of sight and in connection with kinesthesia, which is basically our proprioceptive system, also known as somatosensory. So these 3 kind of systems have to constantly speak to each other. If 2 of them jar, they just send conflicting information to our brain, that is our nervous central system, well, that's it. Or in a fraction of a moment, we will feel nausea, we'll feel dizzy. And that is, again, self-defense mechanism. So it's such a complex and delicate system, that's what I'm driving at, which we should brace ourselves for more and more reaction to that. And as Daniel just mentioned, you know, the privilege of living in thin, tall towers, which is only for few people, actually is bringing back the paradox that sway and tilt, they can hardly be controlled entirely. And so there's actually kind of people who complain about what happens while you inhabit those spaces. So when it comes to technology and those prostheses, which will promise you to see into different worlds, and they actually do deliver the representation inhabiting of virtual realities, well, you know, do we actually know how far we can respond to those, and how people who have, perhaps have different conditions in connection with their balance, how would they, how will they react to those? I think we're only just beginning to see that. So there are both therapeutical uses of those technologies, and there are actually more entertaining ones, more practical ones, which might well bring up issues in the future.
David Adariu, thank you very much for joining us today. This is the author of On Balance, Architecture and Vertigo, and a whole slew of vertigo-related studies. And you've helped us overcome our own fears and anxieties. And I hope that society will continue to benefit from research like yours.
I appreciate that. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure talking.